Welcome to That Anthro Podcast, the podcast dedicated to anthropology. Together, each week, we will be learning from the experts and researchers that are researching our pasts and today's problems. My name is Gabriella Campbell, and I'll be interviewing a new guest each week to bring to you the latest and greatest in anthropology, based right here out of Santa Barbara. Join me for weekly episodes, whether you're an anthropology buff or looking to learn something new. Welcome to That Anthro Podcast. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of That Anthro Podcast. Before we get started, I have a little message about the show. So I would just like to say thank you so much for all the love and support over this last year that I've been producing this podcast. Creating That Anthro Podcast has been every bit of the dream that I ever imagined it to be. And after launching my first episode July 15th with Amy Anderson in 2020, I've produced an additional 41 episodes, each with amazing guests who have taught me as much as I hope they've taught you. My sincerest thanks goes out to each and every guest who took the time to talk with me and to share their story and passions with all of you. However, through this year of developing and growing the podcast, not only have we been going through a global pandemic, but I've also been a full-time student as well as holding an on-campus job. And while it's still been my absolute pleasure to, make the podcast, I found myself being more disorganized than the high standards that I hold myself to. Skipping weeks posting episodes or not having enough time to double check the audio. The fact is, this fall, I will be entering my senior year at UCSB, and with that comes a lot of responsibilities, including starting the graduate school application process and visiting graduate schools. So in the interest of best preparing for the coming senior year, I'll be taking a break from regularly posting episodes this summer. This episode will be the last weekly installment of season one of That Anthro Podcast. But I promise this is not all sad news. I will be releasing a very special one-year anniversary episode on July 15th to mark the 1 year of That Anthro Podcast that'll be a bit different, in which I'll be the one being interviewed. So I hope it'll kind of be a time for me to share a bit more of myself with the listeners, as well as offer an opportunity to reflect on 1 year of having That Anthro Podcast and being a podcaster. It still seems so weird to consider myself a podcaster, but I know I am. So when will I start posting weekly episodes again, and what will my time off look like? Well, June is going to be my vacation month. I am going to definitely enjoy some much-needed time off and relaxation, and even do a little bit of traveling to visit some friends. And then starting in July, it's back to full force, back to my job, and starting an internship with someone you guys are going to remember, past guest Mallory Melton, as well as revitalizing and revamping the podcast. I am planning to create a website, which will have some fun surprises that I won't ruin. I'm also going to be creating a new segment of the show, a new short form episode that I haven't decided yet if it'll be like a weekly thing or a bi-weekly or a monthly thing, but I promise there is a new segment, a new episode of the show coming. So that's really excited. That's really exciting and definitely something to look forward to, especially for all of my osteology lovers. You've got something fun coming your way. Then, all summer, I will be recording new episodes with guests. I just won't be posting them, so I'll be able to perfect them, have everything ready to go, and then in September, I'm going to release what I'm going to call season two. And from September on, we'll do weekly episodes. And this way, since I will have had them kind of backlogged, I can definitely take all the time that it needs to be perfect. And also, people's schedules are constantly changing. And I really don't like my guests feeling any pressure, to reschedule. We all need to reschedule sometimes, and we all have to have, lots of things going on, and we all have to have flexible schedules. So I think this will be the best thing for everyone. And again, it will have me super prepped and ready to go for my senior year of college. So once again, I just want to say thank you guys for all your support. Please continue to follow along, and I promise I'll be coming back better than ever. And in the meantime, get caught up on any episodes you've missed, recommend the podcast to a friend, or maybe even read one of the books I've recommended on the podcast. That's the other thing that's going to be coming in season two, some more book recommendations, because guess what I'm going to do all summer? Read. But that's for my own personal enjoyment. Love reading. But then I'll tell you guys about what I've read, and hopefully maybe you'll get inspired to do the same. Anyway, without further ado, I'm going to get into this week's episode. You know, we have an amazing guest. We always have an amazing guest. But it kind of seems fitting that the first episode was with a PhD candidate at UCSB. And oh my gosh, and I'm just realizing the last episode, I was just going to say, is with a PhD candidate at UCSB. But not only is it a PhD candidate, it's Sarah, who is Amy Anderson's close friend, lab partner, and sits across from her in the IAS lab. And that's how I met Sarah, was when I was working with Amy. So dang, full circle moment. Anyway, super excited to introduce Sarah.
And now a word about the sponsor of our podcast, Anchor.
Hello, listeners. Welcome back to That Anthro Podcast. I'd like to introduce our guest this week, Sarah Alami. So welcome to That Anthro Podcast. I'd love to just give you a little opportunity to introduce yourself and what you're currently researching here at UC Santa Barbara in the Integrative Anthropological Sciences Laboratory.
Hi, Gabby. Thanks so much for inviting me to be part of this podcast. It's a really cool initiative, and I'm super happy to be part of it. So I'm a human behavioral ecologist. So broadly speaking, I'm interested in understanding human variation, so variation in human behavior and in health, and sort of looking at human variation as an adaptive response to ecological and social factors. And that's the broad picture. More specifically, my research focuses on two main areas, gender inequality and issues related to women's social status and position in society. And I also focus on issues of cultural diversity, what you would call quote unquote, you know, integration. So I'm interested in understanding how culturally diverse societies come into existence, how they function, and how we can improve social cohesion in multicultural societies.
That's awesome. I actually didn't know about that last part of your work. I'm really excited to learn more about that. So a really fun connection that maybe some of our listeners who've like been here since the beginning have put together. So Sarah actually works in the same lab as our first ever guest on the podcast, Amy Anderson, which I just thought, wow, that's so cool. I'm ending the first season with this episode. And that's just such a fun full circle moment. You know, you sit right next to Amy in the lab, and actually that's how I was first introduced to you. So I just think it's super awesome and just a fun little coincidence. But I wanted to take this opportunity to give you some time to kind of reflect on your time, you know, as a part of the integrative or the IAS lab, I'll just abbreviate it. And, you know, what were some of your first memories when you joined the lab? What have you enjoyed about working in an environment like that? Obviously, it's been a little bit different during the pandemic, but you were part of that lab for a while before, you know, I think we got all virtual. So I'll let you answer the question.
Right. Yeah. So Amy, in addition to being, you know, really great colleague and a fantastic researcher, she's also a wonderful human being and one of my best friends. So memories, one of my first memories, because I started a little bit, I was an undergrad at UCSB for my last 2 years. And I remember when I first started going to journal club and sort of interacting directly with professors. And I just remember being like, able to talk to them with people that I admired immensely and who I thought were absolutely brilliant. I had read their work, but not necessarily gotten to know them that closely. And I remember thinking, wow, they're just so, well, in addition to being really knowledgeable, they're just so nice and cool. And I can't believe they're just talking to me and they're really nice and humble. I also remember when we started my cohort, so Amy Anderson, Carmen Hove, and Elizabeth Aggi, we all had, you know, proto ideas of what it is that we wanted to do and what direction we wanted to go. And you know, 5 years later, here we are, and I'm quite proud of my little cohort because they all did great, and they basically did exactly what they wanted to do and found a way to do it, sometimes against all odds. And yeah, I feel extremely, extremely privileged and lucky to have gone through grad school with an amazing cohort. I think the experience would have been different had I been, you know, alone. And
yeah.
And in general, the IS department is a really nice and friendly department. I got really lucky, had a really fantastic advisor. I cannot recommend him enough, Dr. Michael Gervin. Just honestly, just very, very good memories. When I'm done, it's going to be really bittersweet too.
Mm-hmm.
It really is my second home.
Yeah. And I mean, the fact that everyone's working on the, you know, well, actually, I don't know if everyone, because I don't know about the work of Carmen or Elizabeth, but, you know, you're all part of the Chimani Life and Health History Project, which is this really unifying, you know, feature of your work, and you're all working on different facets of that data. And it's such an interesting project. I'm glad I got to work on it with it for just a tiny little bit of time, but it's definitely a really cool long-term project.
No, absolutely. So not all of us. So definitely Carmen, Amy and I have worked with the Chimani project and continue to do so. Yeah. And that's also, it's longstanding. So I don't know if the listeners know about it, but it's a long-term biomedical and anthropological project that's based out of Bolivia and sort of co-directed by my advisor, Michael Gervin, and Hilly Kaplan, who's at the University of Chapman right now. And it's longitudinal studies. So it means that they've been collecting data there and providing free medical care to Chimani communities for almost 20 years now. And so they work with the Chimani, who are this small-scale forager horticulturalist population who live in the Bolivian Amazon. And since 2015, they've also been working with Moseten communities, a related population, but a little bit on different region, the Alto Beni, who's a little more market integrated. And yeah, it's been fantastic. I mean, I will always remember I went to the field when I was an undergrad. My last year of undergrad, I talked to Dr. Gervin in shocks, sending me to do some research with the Chimani. And it was an amazing experience. I mean, I knew that that's what I wanted to do right then. And that even if it didn't work out, you know, that just the human experience and being there, I remember living on one of these really small plains and traveling over the Manique River, which is a subsidiary of the Amazon River, and just looking at the view and thinking about my summer there and being like, wow, it was totally worth it. It's yeah. Amazing. I can't believe
that's amazing. You brought up that, you know, you did your bachelor's at UCSB, but something that people may have not know is that you actually were an international student first. So you did your BA and then your MA at UCSB, and now you're working on your PhD, like we were talking about. So I'm really curious to kind of hear about your educational journey and what drew you to school here and kind of just how you ended up on the path that you are now. I'm sure that, you know, there was a lot of consideration that went in, especially since you did come, you know, from out of the country.
Right. So I was born and raised in Morocco, a country in Northwest Africa. My parents are there, all my family's there. And you're absolutely right. I joined the lab in 2014 and I was an undergrad then. So how I got there is kind of like a long story, but grew up in Morocco. And after high school, I actually studied business in France for a while before I realized that a career in, you know, the corporate world wasn't really my thing. But, you know, in my family, my parents' generation are the first to have received a formal education. They're very driven, hardworking, real, you know, self-made people who worked really hard and to pursue their studies and get to where they are in life. So the environment I grew up in was not, has had, if you want, more pragmatic views about education. So I always thought, you know, I would end up becoming an engineer or maybe, you know, like I would work in a bank or something like that. But anthropology, that wasn't something that I knew existed. I didn't know what it was or that it was something you could do, let alone make a career out of. But I have to say that some of the research questions on and topics that I'm interested in and that I'm working on right now, I've always been interested in from a very young age. So I remember when I was in junior high, we had this amazing history and humanities teacher. His name was Mr. Touron, he was French. And he made us read some classic philosophers like Thomas Hobbes and Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and really made us think about human nature and the origins of inequality. So have people always been in a war of all against all because they're selfish and inherently bad, or is human nature good and people are corrupted by bad social systems and circumstances? And and I remember him telling us, you know, the only way really you can get an answer to that question is to either go back in time when things were much simpler, or if you're really lucky, find a way to study the few remaining small-scale societies that aren't as hierarchical or institutionalized as ours. And you know, here I am, however many years later, in my undergrad year, sitting in a seminar on the evolution of human cooperation and sociality with Dr. Gervin, and thinking, wow, oh my God, like I can actually do that and I can make a thing out of that. But these topics, I think, were like spoke to me and continue to do so because of Morocco. And so I grew up in Casablanca, which is a big, one of these really big, noisy, overwhelming cities that are developing rapidly and with lots of wealth and social inequalities. So so I remember I was very young, I can't remember how old I was, not in high school yet, younger than that. I was at a sleepover at a friend's house one night, and that night my parents had gone out with my little sister to eat at their regular restaurant, and that night a group of young men from the shanty towns turned sort of radical fundamentalists blew up the restaurant right next door to the one where my parents were sitting. And and that was really traumatizing. Like I could have lost my entire family that night. It was just out of luck that they came out of it alive. But even though, you know, thinking back on it, even though what this young man did was, of course, you know, horrible and unforgivable, I couldn't help but feel kind of really sorry for them because they were really young. They weren't that much older than me at the time. And had they been a little more lucky in life, provided with a little more opportunities or been more loved, maybe they would have never been indoctrinated to the point of doing something so horrible and becoming sort of increasingly aware of these social inequalities that were right there in front of you. But when you grew up in it, you don't necessarily, it's like, only becomes obvious when sort of like shocking happens. And yeah, that experience and a few others really sort of made me aware of the harm social injustices can do, and that's what really sparked my interests in behavior, the origin of human sociality and social hierarchies and wealth inequality and gender inequality and how we can improve tolerance and so on. But you know, from there, how I ended up at UCSB, during that seminar, the evolution of cooperation seminar, I turned in a final project that Dr. Gervin really liked. And you know, I didn't know much about grad school or how to apply or, but yeah, Dr. Gervin just gave me a chance and he sort of took me under his wing, and I'm incredibly grateful for that.
And like you were saying with those boys who blew up the restaurant, you know, what if they had been introduced to those ideas and those questions of humanity? Like you said, what if they had had that education? What if they had had the chance to talk about or learn a broader perspective than they may have just been forced on them or was a result of their circumstances? It's just education and widening our perspectives is such a more powerful idea than we can even begin to touch on. It really, it's just Yeah, I don't have any words other than it's just bigger than we can even begin to understand.
No, absolutely. I think that you're absolutely right. I mean, I think not only these young men didn't have access to good schooling, perhaps very little schooling to begin with, but then the quality of the schooling as well. But also, you know, when you grow up in a place where you live in really, really crappy situations, and it's unpredictable, where you live isn't legal kind of, and you can get kicked out. And at the same time, there are people next to you who live on another planet with very fancy cars and houses and whatnot. It creates a lot of frustration. And and if you don't have outlets to let that frustration out, like if you don't have access to, I don't know, like sports or art or education or something that sort of bigger than all of that, you know, something that allows you to escape, but also to make sense of the world and try to get out. People are indoctrinated. I mean, these guys, what happened is that this wasn't their idea to blow up that restaurant or a few other places actually in town that year. It was definitely not coming from them. It was coming from an international terrorist organization. They spent a lot of time indoctrinating these guys, so giving them structure, giving them exactly what they lacked, giving them purpose, giving them an identity, giving them that. And and you know, when you're, can all think about, you know, remember what we were like when you're 18, you're still a baby in your head. You may look like a grown-up, but you really are not. You're not. And so it's easy to be manipulated.
Yes. I think we should also take this time to switch to a more positive note. And I'd love to hear what you love about Morocco. What are the things that you maybe have special family connections with that you miss? I know you were saying you hope to get to visit family soon. What do you love about Morocco?
It's a really beautiful country and really diverse and little. It's, you know, it's in the northwest of Africa. You have like Spain and Europe to the north, and then, you know, you have sub-Saharan Africa, and then you have sort of the Middle East to the east a little further. And it's been a crossroad for many people for a long time. And so my favorite thing about it is, it really is the people. I think it's a place where people are really warm and welcoming and very generous and solidary with each other. So for example, you know, I've been doing a little bit of field work in Southeast Morocco recently, and it's an area where there's parts of that area that are very touristic. And when the pandemic hit, a lot of tourists got stuck in that little region, and people are poor there. I mean, they're not all of them are poor, but a lot of people are not very well off financially. And you know, but they really took care of those people who got stuck. So they welcomed them in their houses. They fed them every day. They built little houses for them when they stayed there for a really long time. So people are really hospitable. And there's a sense that it's a place where sometimes it's hard to make a living, but you won't see as many homeless people, for example, just because of this people's solidarity and people taking care of each other in a way. We have a saying, I don't know if something can translate here, but you live out of the goodwill of others, sort of the goodwill of parents, the goodwill of your family. That's how you can make a living, basically. And, you know, goes to show how social relations are important. And that's definitely something that's really important there and valued. And I like that a lot. People spend a lot of time taking care of those precious relations. And that's something I like very much about where I'm from.
I like that too. I think that's a great, great thing. And I hope to visit Morocco. I was actually in Malaga, Spain, and we talked about it. We were like, okay, should we do a trip and go to the markets? And I can't remember why we ultimately decided not to. Oh, because we went to see the
Alhambra?
Yes, the Alhambra. I was like, what is on the tip of my tongue? I was going to say Altamira, the cave that has the that has prehistoric art, which also I would love to see. But yeah, we ended up going to the Alhambra instead. But yeah, definitely, Morocco is on the list for sure. Something about you that is, you know, continues this spirit of, you know, the goodwill of others is you've been a very active and helpful grad student to others around campus. And, you know, recently you actually talked in my graduate prep class and helped share this, you know, the same things we're talking about now, your journey to anthropology and offering any advice that you can, you know, along the way of from what you've learned. So I was curious if you have any advice or experiences that, you know, you could offer to undergraduate students looking to pursue a similar degree that may listen to the podcast.
Right. So, I mean, honestly, outside of research, I have no idea what advice to give students.
Yeah.
I mean, I've never really been strategic about my career. I generally love what I do, but to be completely honest, you know, I oscillate between, you know, what the hell am I doing and how am I going to make a living with this? And I'm having so much fun. This is awesome. I'm having a great time. I don't even care about my life prospects or whatnot. So that's not helpful, is it?
But I feel like that is just as important of advice, because I think lots of times, and I was realizing this as I'm starting the process of looking into grad schools, I was freaking myself out that I didn't know exactly what I want my, you know, PhD to be on. And people have had to sit me down and go, that's okay. That's what it's supposed to be. Yeah, you want to have an idea. You want to have a field. You want to have some concept of things you like. But it's okay. I think we need to shatter that perfect glass bubble around grad school that everything, you know, you have to start on the path that you start on and you can't change anything. Like that's really not the reality. And I think people, it's good. No, not everyone knows what the heck they're doing. That's all right.
Well, absolutely. I mean, honestly, when it comes to a PhD, things will, your ideas will change. They will mature, they will develop. Sometimes they'll entirely pivot in a different direction. But what you really need to, you just need to be really self-driven and kind of open to criticism.
That's
because you're going to learn from very smart and competent people who don't have the time to teach you everything. So you're going to have to do some catching up on your own. You're also going to have to learn, if you're doing a PhD in anthropology, and for example, if you want to join IIS, it's a highly interdisciplinary department with primatologists, human biologists, behavioral ecologists, evolutionary psychologists. And so you need to pick up on lots of different topics and skills, and you pick them up along the way. And you have to be okay with realizing that your first research ideas maybe and drafts are really going to be kind of crappy, not all that great, and as a result, criticized. And yeah, you just have to persevere and sort of enjoy the process of learning and getting better at doing science, because you do get a lot better at it. It's a fun and enjoyable thing to do. And you start to learn how to learn, and then you become really good at learning. And that's very, very satisfying in itself. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you can communicate it to others.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
For your PhD, what questions are you investigating? And we talked about that, you know, some of your data is from the Chimani Life and Health History Project, but the other, you know, part of your data is from, you said, southeastern Morocco?
So I haven't quite yet started collecting data there. It's sort of, so I went, I visited the southeast of Morocco, which isn't a region that I was familiar with. That's not where I'm from, or don't even speak the language they speak there or anything like that. But it's a region that I started going back to frequently during my PhD because of sort of future ideas for potential research projects. So it's a region that has, it's very diverse culturally. So I work in, or I mean, I want to work really, although I did do a lot of ethnography there. It's located in the southern slope of the High Atlas Mountain. So it's sandwiched between the Atlas Mountains, the Saharo Mountains, and the desert, the Ghalil Desert. And it's a small oasis. And it being an oasis, it's at the crossroad of and it has been at a crossroad of sub-Saharan Africa and Northern Africa for many centuries. And as a result, a lot of different groups lived there and sort of fought against each other for access to water and whatnot. And today, people live in different ways. So in the upper side of the oasis, people live off tourism mainly and some agriculture. And in the lower part of the valley, it's a region that really is, like the rest of Morocco, a place of out-migration. So a lot of people have left after Morocco was colonized by France and Spain. And during the French protectorate, a lot of companies from France and other places in Europe, like the Netherlands, and started recruiting men, especially to go work in mines or factories or as a seasonal agricultural worker. So as a result, the transition from an oasis economy, so people who grow food for subsistence or people who are transhumant nomads, so who move from one side to the other to take their goats and sheep to graze, to an area of migration and where people live mostly off remittances, so money that's sent back from wherever your relatives are. And I'm really interested in that because I'm interested in relationship between groups and why we maintain them and this sort of extra community relationship and in a context like that. So how do people keep ties with people who live abroad or to make a living? What kind of relationship there? How do they choose partners? How do they, etc. So that's why I want to work there. On top of that, it's a region that's really interesting for looking at gender inequality. Mm. So it's small, but gender norms are very different between the different groups who live there. So again, in the upper part of the valley, gender norms are sort of relaxed, not as egalitarian as, I don't know, like Norway right now, but women can divorce, women work mostly in tourism. A lot of people have guest houses where they welcome tourists. In the lower side of the valley, people are a little more, not only there's like more sex segregation of space, you can divorce, remarriage after being widowed is a no-no. And on top of that, people are wary of strangers, which isn't the case in the upper valley. So I'm really interested in understanding where do these differences come from. Is it just because of the way people make a living right now, or is it because of sort of historical differences between groups and or old subsistence patterns and whatnot? And so that's the idea. It's a project, yeah. A proto project. That's what I want to do after my PhD. I really want to work hard I want to continue working in Bolivia, of course, but I would like to develop this project a little more and spend more time collecting data in Morocco.
No, that sounds super fascinating. And what I wanted to talk about was, I was looking at your website, and I think one of the really interesting things that, you know, you're studying is women's status and leadership. And I'm curious, because I actually have no idea kind of what the social dynamics are in the Chimani population, because as you know, the work that I did with Amy was primarily like osteologically related.
So my first time in the field in 2014, I did a bunch of things, but among the things I did was help Christopher van Ruden, who's a professor at the School of Leadership Studies at the University of Richmond and a previous student of Mike, my Gervin, my advisor, was to help him collect data on women's social status among Chimane. So he looked at men a lot, but he had never done anything with women. And I also had, you know, was also interested. And what we did is that we, the original idea was to look at sex differences in sort of leadership and status and influence between men and women. So basically took photos of everyone in a village and asked people to rank each other on a series of questions. So who do you think has the greatest influence in community meetings? So basically who gets there, who has whose voice carries the most weight in community meetings. That's how, that was the exact question if I were to translate it into English. And there were other questions like who's good at managing projects, community projects, who begets more the most respect in the community. And so people sort of ranked each other. We got a ranking on this status measure. And what we did with Chris was compare men and women, and that's a different paper from my own paper. So that's so we found that even though men in general sort of were seen as higher status, there was a lot of overlap between men and women, and that the differences we saw weren't necessarily a result of just gender per se, but mostly they were the result of sort of differences in body strength, differences in education between men and women, and differences in the number of cooperation partner you have. And that's what one of the things that really mattered. And so I got really interested. That's what where my interest in women's status started developing. And so in the literature in general, literature on the gender gap and things like that, you have two ways of looking at the question. Of course, there's a lot of constraints, right? There's a lot of things women aren't able to do because of societal circumstances. So when you have children, you don't have time to pursue a career if you're the main caretaker for your mm-hmm. children, or you're in a system that's not designed to be welcoming to women. A lot of things like that. But there's another side of the story, which is, well, are there differences in the motivations for pursuing status? Do men and women pursue status for different reasons? And maybe that's why we see differences in competition and things like that. With the idea that men in general tend to be more competitive, at least overtly competitive, than women. And that's the question I wanted to explore. So are there differences? There's a lot of rich, vast literature on why men seek status, because of that idea, again, that the intuitive sort of evidence that men compete more than women, but also because of theoretical underpinnings drawn mainly from the animal behavior and the evolutionary science literature on social hierarchies. So the idea that men are more competitive has been associated with them being able to leverage their social position for sexual access to mates, which results in producing more children and propagating more genes in natural fertility settings, at least. So if you think about men like Genghis Khan, for example, who were really powerful men, conquered vast areas of land and were able to monopolize access to multiple mates, maybe had big harems. I think, I don't know how many children Genghis Khan left, but I think quite a lot, in the thousands, yeah. Right? But, you know, women's reproduction is constrained. Even if all you do is reproduce, you still have to be pregnant for 9 months. You still have to, in natural sort of traditional populations, you have to breastfeed most of the time. So that's like almost an entire year. And then you have to get pregnant again. And anyway, it's you're more constrained than men. And yeah. I don't know, the max, if you're not twinning, right, you can have maybe, if you start real early, maybe you'll end up with, I don't know, 22 kids at most, but you'll never be in the thousands, right? Mm-hmm. So the idea that maybe fertility isn't, so access to mates maybe isn't what drives women necessarily, or not, maybe it is, but fertility per se is not what mm-hmm. drives access to mates for women. But so what does? We looked at literature from different disciplines that looks at the societal level, you know, when women are better represented in politics and whatnot, things tend to get better for children. Mm-hmm. There's also some evidence that women tend to be more competitive when it's about their kids, for example. And we wanted to look at whether indeed our measure of status associated with child survival. And we didn't necessarily have data on survival per se, but we had data on health, on child health outcomes among the Chimani longitudinal data over many, many years. And so we looked at women's status in relationship to that. So, and we did find indeed that women who yielded greater political influence in their community, so women whose voice was carried the most weight during community meetings tended to have healthier children. We looked at metrics. We also looked at clinical diagnosis from the Chimane Project's doctors. And the idea is that, well, maybe the ability to sway community decision perhaps allows them to access resources, improve resource access, basically, for their families. Or maybe, you know, these women who are vocal in community meetings are also vocal at home, and they have more bargaining power as well, things like that. So yeah, that was the study. I had a lot of fun doing that, and it's a very cool literature. I think it's in anthropology, at least, or other sister disciplines, it's women's cooperation, competition, women's social networks, which is also something I look at, are like, how do you say, blooming?
Yeah, flourishing, yeah. Blooming.
Areas of research, and that's really exciting because for a long time, nobody cared about it. So it's nice that it's happening right now. My dissertation is it's a bit different, but related nonetheless. I look at, so basically the goal of my dissertation is to understand what drives people to marry across cultural boundaries, to form kinship relationships across cultural boundaries. And so it's, I'm interested in that because intermarriage, or it's often used, you know, as an indicator of minority integration and social cohesion, things like that. And from an anthropological perspective, it's also really interesting. It's an interesting question because of two things, basically. Well, first one is that compared to other species, we humans are really unique at forming and maintaining peaceful relationships between groups. And often cooperative relationships between groups. That doesn't happen in other species. The other thing is that human structure is really unique. Human social structure is very different from that of, for example, other primates. So these things may not seem related, but I'll try to explain as best as I can where I see the connections. So in our primates, so dispersals, basically the movement of individuals from the place where they were born to their breeding group is often sex biased. So for example, in macaques and other cercopithecine monkeys, it's often males who disperse, and in chimps, it's females who disperse. But more importantly, like when they disperse, they don't really maintain relationships with their natal group. Like once you're gone, you belong to a different group and that's it. Like you're not gonna go back to your natal group and just hang out and visit your mom or whatnot. Humans are very different, right? So the parallel, if you want, to dispersal is postmarital residence or postmarital group affiliation. And, you know, it's sometimes men, sometimes women who move out. But irrespective of that, what's really unique about humans is that you keep those relationships with your parents once you don't just forget who they are. You keep loving them. You go back and visit them. Mm-hmm. You keep ties with both groups. You also develop new ties with your in-laws. We have fictive kinship, right? Like we have terms to call a mother-in-law, a sister-in-law. They're also our family, even though we're not related by blood. And there's this really long-standing idea in anthropology that dates back to Claude Lévi-Strauss in the 1940s, and even other people before that, where that this pattern, reciprocal exogamy, so exchanging marriage partners between groups, is what so in a systematic way is how sort of groups come together. And more recently, you know, researchers like primatologists like Bernard Chappet or other behavioral ecologists like Rob Walker have argued that this practice of exchanging, you know, marriage partners with alliances among in-laws and whatnot is what led early hominins to develop more complex social structures. And, you know, you're able to belong to different groups at the same time, and group belongingness, and that's not a word, is very fluid and flexible. So all this to say that intermarriage played an important role in our evolutionary history. So I look at the drivers of intermarriage in two communities that are located in the Alto Beni region of Bolivia. And it's a place that's sandwiched between the Amazon and the Andes. Oh. And so it's native to the Moseten, who are a group that's related to the Chimane, a group of forager, traditionally, you know, back in the days, forager farmers turned forager horticulturalists, and now they engage in commercial agriculture, etc. But it's also a region that has experienced a really important influx of migrants from the Andes, especially because after a national revolution and some, you know, agrarian reform and whatnot, people started coming from different regions, from the overpopulated Altiplano. And as a result, you have these communities that are heterogeneous, that are very culturally diverse. And I'm really interested in looking at whether there are people intermarry just because of, you know, they run out of options, or just because it's convenient, they marry whoever's around, or if there's more to it. So whether they intermarry in order to improve access to resources. So for instance, the group that's native to the region, the Moseten, have preferential access to land because their indigenous land is protected. And so they have more land basically. Whereas these other groups who come in tend to be a little more market integrated. They know how to do business better. And so they also have something to offer. So that's one possibility. And that's something that I'm finding actually in my data. Another possibility is what we call risk buffering. So yeah, resource access was one hypothesis. Another thing was, the idea that intermarriage maybe smooths the risk of exogenous shocks to food production. So say something happens where you live, or something's happened to your group, so for example, where I work in Bolivia, there's been, in addition to COVID, there has been this really bad papaya infection, papaya being the main cash crop that people grow. And people who relied heavily on papaya are really in a bad situation. People who didn't have other ways to make a living really hit hard economically. But you know, if you have, if you're married to a family where, you know, they get their living, they grow, for example, cacao, or who have a taxi, or who do some wage labor, maybe you're more buffered and you're better able to deal with what we call, you know, exogenous shocks to production. So things from the outside that affect your economy, basically. And let alone you have access to support network and social network that don't rely on the same resources. So maybe that's one reason why people may intermarry. And I'm also looking at attitudes towards diversity and multiculturalism. So for example, I'm interested in how people switch from identifying with their, you know, small little group, like saying, for example, I'm from Beau Séjour, this neighborhood in Casablanca, to saying I'm Moroccan, to saying I'm a citizen of the world, kind of thing. So same thing, I'm looking at that there. How do you go from saying your Quechua, Aymara, or Museten, or Chimane, to identifying as Bolivian, and how that process happens. So I'm really interested in that, because supposedly it helps, right? It blurs group boundaries, and it helps you feel like you're part of the same common project and whatnot. So the process of nation building. So these are all things I look at in my dissertation. Yeah. Sort of similar question that I would like to continue exploring in Morocco. And and behavioral ecology is really great for.
So I'm actually stealing from another podcast that's an amazing podcast that everyone should check out, especially if you love the show Queer Eye with Jonathan Van Ness. He has his own podcast called Getting Curious with Jonathan Van Ness. And as I look for ways to just, you know, improve my own podcast, something he asks his guests at the end is, we've reached the end of the episode. Do you have anything else that you would like the listeners to know? Any questions you have for me, or anything else that you would like to share before we end off?
So I'm thinking about the audience of the podcast. So if I'm speaking to, if a lot of, for example, undergraduates in anthropology are listening to this, one thing I want to encourage them to do is as you said, you know, to take a behavioral ecology class. It's really it's an awesome discipline. It takes a really holistic perspective on behavior and both biological and social phenomena. It provides explanations, like very satisfying explanations to things that genuinely blow my mind, like why do we have music, or how did religion evolve, and it's able to do that in a sort of deep and holistic way, not just, you know, just evolves because of blah, 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 but more allows you to look at the broader picture, and to see how social phenomena arise because of different pressures, both ecological, social, etc. And so I don't know if that makes sense at all.
No, that definitely makes sense.
Give them more like an example.
Yeah, no, you did a great pitch of your field.
So let me give you an example. I think maybe that will help listeners, because it's not a very well-known discipline. I mean, it's not even for example, I'm not in a behavioral ecology department per se. It's just a way of doing things. So so if you think about any social phenomenon, like take for example, you know, religion, for instance, right? It's something that's universal, you see it everywhere, but it looks different in different parts of the world. But how come we even have something like that? So if you take a behavioral ecology perspective, you're going to learn, for example, about life, you're going to learn about different things, and then it's going to be like a puzzle that you put together at the end. So you're going to learn about life history theory and why humans and like other species rely on very difficult to acquire and unpredictable sources of food, and how we have this long prolonged life after reproduction, and what that does to our mind, our ability to project in the future and believe in something like the afterlife, right? And you'll also learn about, right, how we get our food and how we rely on difficult to acquire unpredictable sources of food, and how that, what that does to the importance of social bonds and relationships, and our need for monitoring other people's behavior and making sure they're not defecting and they're good operators, and how do we do that in societies that are too large to monitor and are anonymous. You also learn about, you know, like food sharing and different models of food sharing and things like costly signaling, for example, and for example, how showing off, albeit honestly, you know, qualities like generosity and whatnot can be the same as showing devotion, and how that does, how that helps your reputation and your ability to have a cooperation partner. Just the ideas you take, instead of, you know, just taking something and being like, this is adaptive because of that, you take a more holistic view on the question, and you're able to make sense of it by gathering different pieces of the puzzles from different things you learn. And I think that's very cool.
I agree.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today. It means a lot, and it was great to catch up with you.
Thank you so much, Gabby. I had a lot of fun.